We made this. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the XCast. The truth is in here. My name is Kurt North, and I am your host for this week for our continuing coverage of Season 6 of The X-Files. And joining me, as always, is a guest. I've actually got the showrunner with me, co-showrunner, in Carl Sweeney. Carl, how are you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm doing okay, thanks, Kurt. Okay. I mean, I've prepared solidly to discuss Monday. Do you know how I've prepared?
Go on.
I've lived through a basically unchanging daily routine with only minute variations for about a year at this point.
About a year, so, yeah, I would say about a year is about right.
Yeah. So, yeah, glad to be here.
Are you that bored of it that you're actually moving in slow motion now, or are you all right?
Well, I think by the end of this podcast, that might happen. Yeah, no, I just think I'm going to take this approach from now on. I'm going to do like method acting for our podcasts. So, haven't figured out how I'm going to prepare for the Badlar episode yet. We'll see.
And I've noticed you've not put yourself up for Aguamala, because that would have been quite nice to put yourself into an area like that, really. That would have been good. join us as a guest, and that guest is Colin. Colin Waters-Botley, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, Kurt. How are you?
I'm good. I've had a podcasting week. I've been editing, I'm on holiday, so what I do for holidays is generally work harder, and I don't get why I do that, but, you know, one of those things, really. But yeah, not too bad.
Can I just suggest something before we go too much further?
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys think. I'm feeling that we've done so many episodes of the X-Cast. We've done over 500, haven't we, by this point?
Yeah.
Do we really need to cover Monday, actually? Why don't we just skip straight from Aguamala to Arcadia, and you know, no one will notice. No one will know.
I don't know.
Well, actually, hang on. You know what? Do you guys hear that weird ticking noise? I think something is weird about. There's like a noise. Do you hear that?
I do now.
Yeah. What is that?
Oh no.
Uh-oh.
No. So, Colin, how are you doing? What's up?
You know, I'm doing good. I feel pretty good. The sun's out today.
Oh, brilliant stuff. Brilliant. Well, you know, it's what are your Mondays like usually without a pandemic? Do you have a boring Monday? Do you have a routine? Or
I do. I'm a morning person, so I have a pretty established routine, no matter what day of the week it is.
Fantastic. Well, that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're talking about the X-File episode Monday. It was season 6, episode 14. It was written by Vince Gilligan and directed by the wonderful Kim Manners. And it originally aired on the 28th of February, 1999. So, Carl, what are your general thoughts on this episode then?
I think it's great. I really do. I think this is my favourite episode of season 6 so far that I've talked about on the podcast this season. I think it's really good at the way it balances the drama and the comedy quite well, I think. I don't know what you guys feel, but like the drama is quite weighty, isn't it? Like the themes are quite serious and heavy. What's happening with Pam is quite ultimately quite tragic, but it's actually a genuinely funny episode too. I think it does that really well. I think it balances those things better than some of the other episodes this season. I think, Kurt, when we talked about Terms of Endearment, I said I wasn't that fond of how you had some comedy in there with the darkness.
Yeah.
But this one does it really well. I think the script's very good, because we'll talk about this as we go on. I think it leads you into some things quite subtly, and then it kind of develops as the episode continues. At the same time, everything that's happening kind of speaks to the underlying ideas. But it doesn't feel too, you know, for a high-concept episode, I don't feel too kind of browbeaten by the end of it, you know, and hit over the head with stuff. I think you mentioned Kim Manners. I think he rises to the challenge as well because he keeps it all fresh and engaging, even though it's quite repetitive in theory. I think the actors do as well. I think the actors do a really good job. So very well cast episode two with the guest stars. So one of the best episodes of season six for me.
It's nice to hear you say that, Carl, because every time we've recorded together, it's always been a bit dour. No. It's another episode that Carl doesn't... I wouldn't say you've never said you hated an episode, but it's kind of like...
It's true.
It's all right, all right. Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I think the way that I've looked at talking through this episode is to talk about... As the loops go through, there's various elements that are brought in and out of it. And so I think we'll talk about the general concept of it. I mean, what do you think to it, Cortland?
Yeah, one of the first things that I was thinking about as I rewatched was exactly what Carl was talking about, the balance between the comedy and the drama of it. Because I think when I remember this episode or just sort of think about it in passing, I think about the comedic elements of it. And tend to think of it as a really funny and entertaining episode. But as I was rewatching, it was really very sad. It's very sad. Yeah. And I think it does a really remarkable job having both of those things, you know, in there.
Yeah. But for me, it's like a bit of, it's quite interesting that three of us have kind of coming at it a little bit differently because mine is the concept. I'm a huge fan of this type of events, you know, this type of show. I mean, I've been thinking about this over the last few days and talking about it, and it's the concept itself is really interesting. I know, Carl, that you watched the episode for the Twilight Zone, which it was based on. But this concept is quite flexible because if you look at some of the other shows around, you know, the actual event itself, you know, the repetitive Groundhog Day style. There's a Star Trek one, Cause and Effect, which is very sci-fi. It's very kind of straightforward, and it's just a simple story. But then you get two of my favorite time loop episodes is Heaven Sent by Doctor Who. That time loop doesn't kick in till 45, 50 minutes into the episode, and it's only for the last 10 minutes, and it's more a mystery box story, and it deals with grief. And the Fringe episode, White Tulip, which deals with, you know, the fact that it's a character who's trying to get back to his wife died and he wants to go back and he keeps replaying these time loops to try and do that, to try and work out how he can be with his wife again. And at that same time, it's a character piece to move that episode forward for the main characters. Yes. So there's so many different ways that you can do this episode. And I think that, as you say, with the X-Files, it's kind of focused on the themes of, like, you know, say, free will and things like that, which is really interesting. I mean, what was the Twilight? Because the Twilight Zone one, I think it's called Shadow Play. Is that right?
Yeah, it's called Shadow Play. And Vince Gilligan has spoken about the fact that everybody says this episode is the X-Files does Groundhog Day. And he says, well, actually, I was ripping off the Twilight Zone. Now, in my opinion, this episode is more reminiscent of Groundhog Day than it is of that Twilight Zone episode. Because in Shadow Play, what happens is you see it's about a guy who... he thinks he's trapped in a recurring dream where he's on death row. But the loop plays its way out all the way through once, and then the final scene is kind of back to the beginning. So you don't get that level of repetition that you get in something like Monday, where you go through several versions of it. So Groundhog Day is the classic example, isn't it? I think Tony, in one of the comments, says that he kind of gets a bit miffed that everybody says it's the X-Files does Groundhog Day, but... The thing is that Groundhog Day is the one that's become the synonym for being stuck in a dead end, repetitive situation, isn't it?
Just
somebody says to you, this is like Groundhog Day today for me. You know exactly what they mean. And it kind of spawned all these other narratives that are comparable to it. And like we've been talking this week, haven't we? Yeah, kind of off air about things like Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise film, where it's all about saving the world. And there are, you know, horror films like Happy Death Day, which are kind of comparable to. As well as the Star Trek stuff you mentioned and so on.
Mm.
And I was thinking about why they appeal. And I think they're fun. They're fun in kind of a self-reflexive way, aren't they? It's just fun to see how the writers and the actors and the directors handle that kind of scenario. Can they do it in a way that holds your attention without becoming unnecessarily dull and repetitive? Can it be done in a way that marks it out as different from something like Groundhog Day or some of these other comparison points?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, like, how they appeal to us. I think something like Monday it strikes a chord because a lot of it's very relatable, isn't it? I think anyone who's been stuck in a job that they don't particularly enjoy can get on board with the idea of, like, you know, waking up on a Monday morning, running a bit late or whatever it is. So some of these scenarios, going to the bank and having to clear a check so that something can happen, very relatable. Sometimes with something like Groundhog Day, you get an element of, like, thrill-seeking or living vicariously through them, don't you? You get to a point where Bill Murray's kind of enjoying the scenario and he's having some fun with it. I don't think we ever really get that in Monday.
I think because of their point of view. It's not really Mulder and Scully that they're reliving it. We're seeing it through them, but it's not. It's her, isn't it? So,
and it adds to the tragedy of it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing. What the best of these stories do, and what I think Monday does well, is it's the idea of a character changing in some way because you've got this kind of static concept or a looping concept. So it means that the idea of somebody taking charge or becoming a better person or whatever becomes particularly important. And that's the way Hollywood storytelling or, you know, mainstream storytelling works anyway. You know, within the space of a 2-hour story, you can, you know, learn to like dogs or, you know, you can overcome some kind of inherent character flaw. But I think that's just, like, really amped up in, like, a time loop tale, isn't it? And that's what's fun about them.
Yeah. I think. Yeah. I mean, Colin, have you watched many of these films? I mean, we've talked a bit off there about some bits. I wonder why you're laughing.
No. No, that's not true. I mean, obviously, I've seen Groundhog Day. I did see that Tom Cruise movie, Edge of Tomorrow. I am familiar with the Doctor Who episode that you mentioned. You know, I'm sure that I've seen others, too. I think that's a time loop, like, story as a story. It's pretty common, even if it's not as central. You know, this is like an episode that is about a time loop. I don't think, you know, I think there it comes into things more often than we would probably realize unless we were actively, like, looking for them.
Yeah.
But I do think that the one thing this one does really well is manage to go through the same scenes many times without it being boring. Because it could have been much more boring than it actually turned out to be.
Yeah. I mean, it gets IMDb rated at 8.9 out of 10. And that's from 3,290 votes. So what would you rate out of 10, Colin, first? What would you say?
Probably not quite that high. Maybe like an 8, probably.
Okay. And Carl?
I'm more like a 9, to be honest. Really, really good. I think the only reason, there's nothing wrong with it that, you know, I'm not saying there's something wrong with it, and that's why I'm not higher than a 9, but I reserve my 10s for, like, you know, the things that, like, define the series. And I don't think this does that as such, but it's a really, really good episode. And I've enjoyed it even more, having watched it a few times, not on a loop, but over the last few days. I appreciate this even more than I did, you know, before I started doing that. So I really like this episode.
Yeah, I think for me, I bump it down to an 8, specifically once we get to the end. And we can talk about it more later. But I think that it's really, really good. And then it loses it a little bit for me in its conclusion.
Yeah. Right, okay. I mean, I would probably say a 9 as well, actually. I think it's one of those episodes, and season 6 is guilty of this for quite a lot of them, where you can put on, you know, it's quite an episode that you can just go, right. I mean, for example, I was watching it last night. We were waiting for shopping to be delivered, and it was like, we don't want to put something on where we're going to have to sit down and concentrate on it. So I just went, I need to do Monday again. I'll watch it again. And my other half was like, that's that Groundhog Day one, isn't it? I was, yeah. And, she watches X-Files with me, but not all the time. She's not a fan of it, but she enjoys episodes. And it, for a while, she was like, what happens at the end? And then it's that, by about the third one, she was like, oh yeah, I know what happens. It's her, isn't it? I said, yeah, that's fine. So it is one of those ones that you can just, you know, it's like that, that method of, like, you can just put this episode on. It's a self-contained story. It's great from that point of view as well.
So, you mentioned that it's comparable to some of the season 6 episodes in that way. So do you guys think this really, like, really fits well with the season 6 kind of ethos? Because I think Darren, in his review of the episode, had talked a bit about this. And I was thinking about it, and then I looked back at his review. I must have read it a few years ago and remembered the point. But in season six, you get this sense of the characters being in this kind of cycle, don't you? Because things like their return to the status quo, ultimately, after two fathers, one son, of the classic status quo. But even in episodes like Dreamland, you know, the idea of being, we're in this car, are we ever going to get out? Are we ever going to go and do something else, lead a normal life?
Mm.
And then various episodes you can pin it down to, but things like the field trip discussion, where it's like, why do we always go for this perfunctory dance? And Mother says, like, well, I'm always right, like 98% of the time, or whatever it is. Do you know what I mean? So maybe, does it speak to those kind of overarching ideas in quite a nice way? I think it does, to be fair.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, just while I'm thinking about it, the through line of Tithonus as well, where she says, you know, you need to live. And the fact that she says that in the second loop, you know, so there's definitely a thematic link of, you know, there's if they're not stuck in a rut, or they are stuck in a rut, they need to find a direction out of that. And I think that's probably, I can see that in a multitude of different episodes, yeah?
Yeah, well, because it's such a long-running series by this point that, that's part of the challenge, right? Is finding these variations on the basic concept, which gets more and more difficult. You know, the writers have written so many scripts and the actors have played these roles for so long. Even in a series as flexible as The X-Files, you know, you've got these things, these beats you need to hit and so on. So I don't know. What do you reckon, Colin? It does speak to that kind of that long-running sense quite nicely, I think.
Yeah, well, season six is my favorite season, probably because we get so many of these sort of more experimental episodes. I mean, I love the early seasons. I love them. I think they're really wonderful, but I like how playful season six is. And I think that this is a really good example of that sort of different concept for how we're going to run this, like run an episode, run a story through it. And I think you're right about it mirroring sort of where they are in the overarching scope of the story in season six, where they're clearly trying to grow up a little bit, but it's difficult. It's obviously difficult.
All right, okay then. So I think that's the general kind of thought over and over. What do you think about maybe going into the show in a bit more depth? Let's start from the top and work our way down.
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I've got a weird sense of deja vu, actually. But my basic feeling is that we've covered the basics here, haven't we? You know, we've talked about the time loop episode, how it fits in season six.
Yeah.
The fact that it's one of the better episodes of the season, in my view, 9 out of 10. Why don't we just wrap up here? We've done what? We've done quite a... No, we've done the 15 minutes, a good 15 minutes. We could just put this out as like a mini episode. I think
like a pod watch episode. Well, I don't know.
Wait,
yeah. I don't
you
know.
Guys, wait.
Yeah?
Something weird is happening. Do you guys...
What's that noise?
What, that ticking sound?
Yeah. Yeah. Can you guys hear it too?
I can.
Is that your mic? No.
I don't know. I can't figure it out. Sorry.
What is it?
No.
I mean, even like Person of Interest has a version of it as well, because they kind of like they have a computer simulation, and the simulation plays out all the potential ways of getting out of this building that they've been surrounded by, and have these gunshots going off and all kinds, and you see all these different variations, the variables, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in Monday as well, because obviously there's the variable aspect in this one. But the fact that in the computer in Person of Interest is trying to protect the people, because it's protecting itself by doing that, and I think that's really interesting. So I think after that, I think we need to maybe go into the episode in a bit more depth, if you think. What do you think?
I think we might have to at this point, yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
No problem. Let's do it. Okay, so we get the opening credit scene to bring us up to that explosion and the day resets. And without going into too much detail about that, because it's just setting kind of the scene, but the first kind of post-credit loop is kind of like after the media res in some bizarre way. But it has to, what the first part has to do is explain the day. So in a lot of ways, it's the same as a normal episode in a lot of ways. It needs to set out the pieces so we can get the comedy, so that can be derived in later ones. You've got, you know, hints at like Mulder recognizing the loop and things. So it needs to really set the stall out for the episode. I mean, from this first loop, do you remember like watching it for the first time, Colin, at all? Because obviously you've watched it later on, haven't you? So do you remember seeing this for the first time?
I don't. No. I don't remember. I don't. No. But I do think one of the things about the first loop in particular is I think it's the funniest. This is, for me, when the episode is the funniest in terms of just the straight up comedy of seeing Mulder have such a really bad morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Carl, what do you think to the actuals? It has to do things, doesn't it? It has to get the trainers in there. It has to do the waterbed scene. It has to the phone call, the mobile phone, and everything like that. Like setting those pieces up as well as just doing the comedy aspect of it. And as I say, the variations that happen in the loop following it as well. You know, the fact it's kind of like it's explaining everything that's happened post credits, really.
Yeah, really good. I think it does those things well, because there's a famous Alfred Hitchcock quote, which is that cinema is life with all the boring bits cut out. And I think part of the appeal of a time loop story is actually the opposite. It's quite fun to have this character who we normally see, you know, doing very dynamic things, but here he's doing very mundane things. You know, he's woken up, he's late. I mean, it said 7:15, but it must have not had enough time to get to work for this meeting. So he's running late, it looks like. It's just very interesting and amusing. I think it sets up some ideas quite well too, though. You know, the idea that you see the clock that's not working because the plug got wet or whatever. So that reinforces the sense of time is kind of stuck at the same time as his watch is still ticking on and he's running a bit late. So relatable. And at the same time, you know, it's a very ordinary bad day kicking off. In this very extraordinary circumstance, and it's quite a nice blend.
Yeah, and it's nice to see that, isn't it? Because you can't imagine. And my question would be, right, how do Walter Skinner, Mulder, and Scully end up in the same room in that board meeting? How do they actually end up in that meeting in the first place?
Like how is it relevant to their work on the X-Files or what? I don't know.
Just imagine it's some kind of real... I mean, obviously it's a really boring meeting, but it's clearly some sort of like quarterly... department meeting that Skinner has to run and has to invite them to.
and don't you think the fact that it's a Monday is relevant too? Because I don't think the episode draws much attention to it, except you see it on Mulder's watch, don't you? But it's a Monday. Mm. But for a lot of people, I have
a meeting on a Monday, and in usual circumstances, even though I work 7 days a week, over the 7 days. That Monday I have to be in because it's the meeting day. So it's totally relatable.
And there's just something about it being a Monday morning that makes it that much worse, right? We can imagine that they've had a weekend or he's had a weekend to do whatever Mulder does on the weekends when he's not on an X-File. And now he's late for this terrible meeting that I'm sure he doesn't want to go to anyway. And his waterbed is leaking into the apartment below him. And
I mean, he's got so form. He's got form, though. He's always late for meetings.
Sure.
Yeah, but he's supposed to be presenting a report at this meeting, isn't he? And
the unpredictable future.
Yeah, I was going to say, again, doesn't go well for profilers, does it? You know, the fact that that you've got the crime. So crime is basically going to be unpredictable for the next year. Thanks.
Great.
Well, really that's good. That's kind of what I mean, though. It's kind of low-key and it's almost background, but it is relevant to what's going on, and it's quite fun. And I think I was telling you guys on Twitter earlier that the actor is actually also in a couple of other X-Files episodes. He's in the beginning. He's the guy who's droning on and on in the meeting. He's the guy who makes the remark about Men in Black in the beginning, and he's also in Via Negativa. So I'm assuming it's the same character.
I can't think. Do you remember what he was in Via Negativa?
I don't remember, and I didn't have time to check that before we started recording, to be honest. Okay. So, can you remember, Colin?
No, I was thinking about it. I feel like there are a lot of extra kind of agents running around in Via Negativa, though. I think because there are, you know, lots of scenes with extra agents. Mm.
Can I just point out something, Kurt, about the earlier stuff with Mulder at the apartment?
Yeah.
I just think it's very good comedy. You know, the fact the Coveney juggle in the saucepan and trying to patch the leak up and stuff. I think it's really fun.
Yeah, this kind of slapstick kind of humor with the element of it, yeah.
And I'm not sure whether it's the first act or is it later. Is there a certain appendage that is potentially visible at some point. I don't
know. Well, why did you bring that up now?
I think it's this one.
It was going to be an appendix for me, not an appendix, not a forefront in the mind.
Cortland, do you want to handle this?
Listen, I would never claim to be an expert. There are a lot more well-versed.
You know people, Cortland.
So. I do know people. if they're going to dress him in pale yellow cotton pajama pants and then soak him in waterbed water, I don't know what they thought was going to happen, but congratulations, fandom.
I think we need to explain, I don't want to explain it, but I think somebody needs to, because I've never noticed this until I was told about it recently.
I only became aware of this in season 11 with the coffee cup. So I think Colin needs to explain.
Season 11 with the because he goes by Bob, yes, in the coffee shop. Got it. Okay. I was like, I don't understand the connection here. Got it. So how do I explain this without a visual in front of, you can all watch the episode. Hopefully you're watching it.
Have you not got it time stumped?
No.
I think I know someone who might.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes,
in a spreadsheet somewhere.
I think we all know someone who might. But, he gets soaking wet. He's wearing his pajama pants. And maybe we get a little peek at a certain appendage that we don't usually see from Mulder. But we do see from David Duchovny in some other shows quite often.
Yeah. Including when he gets asphyxiated in one film as well.
Which film was that?
I think it was, I can't remember what film that was now. Was it Playing God?
I haven't seen that.
Maybe.
I can't remember, but there's definitely a film where there's erotic asphyxiation.
Again.
Yeah.
Not an expert.
But why Bob? Again, not an expert.
Not an expert. I honestly have no idea why they call it Bob. But apparently they do. The people have named his penis Bob, and I don't know.
I think
it's a little funny that it's in this episode though, because of the connection to Groundhog Day, and then through Bill Murray to the other Bill Murray movie, What About Bob? It's a little funny that that's happening in this episode.
So, like I said, we've done over 500 episodes of the X-Cast at this point. I'm pretty confident. Is this the first mention of Bob on the podcast?
I think it might be.
Are we plumbing new depths at this point? I don't remember hearing it discussed before.
No, I don't think.
I can't think of any other time it would have been a topic.
We've lasted 514 episodes or something. 513 episodes, I think.
See, this is what happened when... This is what happens when Tony Black steps away. It all descends into the,
yeah. Yeah, it all descends
this
into madness.
This is important fandom. This is important information for the fandom to have.
It is. And if I take myself out of these shoes and was listening to this, this would be the first time I'll be hearing about it. Had I not been involved in these conversations, and it was only recently that I found out as well. So the fact that it's lasted.
Now, when you see people tweeting a GIF of David Duchovny from Monday and just saying Bob in the caption, you'll know what's happening.
Explicit content here within.
Right. It gets censored. It's a sensitive tweet.
Okay.
Can I just make a slightly different point? Sorry. It was earlier I said that I like the way the episode is fairly subtle about certain things. And I think that applies to Mulder and Scully's first meeting in the office, when they speak, because... I think that first convo, it doesn't really lay out the themes as directly as it will later, when they talk more about free will versus fate and destiny and all that. Kind of like in the teaser, really, where there's a Scully says to Bernard in the teaser, "You're in charge," but they kind of hit that idea a bit more hard later on, So I think the early part of the episode is more comedic, and it kind of withholds some of these ideas to develop them a bit later on, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, the actual line I was just about to read was Bernard has control, because it layers that in. And as I say, we touched upon it earlier. I touched upon it earlier where she's saying, I just want everyone to live. That as I say, that tithiness kind of link in that she has that look on life, the fact that everyone, needs to enjoy their life as much as they possibly can. And she's just wanting to get to that point. I also want to bring up the woman and I think it's a really nice little niche touch that whenever that woman is in Mulder's company, she doesn't freak out. But when he's not, or when he's pulled away from that, because the woman in line, and whenever she is, she then freaks out and becomes like absolutely all over the place. And it's just a little touch that. And I think that that's, you know, it's something that I've probably not really noticed before without critiquing it. The fact that, you know, when he's on the floor and he's going zippity-doo-dah and says everything's going to be okay, she starts to freak out, but she doesn't go that far. And then when he's removed from that situation, she does. I just think that's a nice little variable that they put in there.
I hadn't really thought about that, yeah.
Yeah, the other thing I noticed in this sort of first cycle is that while he's standing in line, he's kind of like, he's kind of singing to himself or something. He's kind of like, da da da. Like, it's, you can see his like mouth moving. I mean, not really, I don't think he's really saying anything. But, you know, later he's standing in line repeating the phrase over and over again. But in this one, he's kind of doing that, just not saying the thing. Like,
zippity-doo-dah. Yeah, he's got to be singing sort of, that as maybe.
You know, he's just kind of like singing to himself, but he's still standing there like with his, you know, his lips are moving. And I thought that was really, I was like, oh, that looks like it could be the same as at the end, even though it's different.
He should have been singing the Boomtown Rat song, I Don't Like Mondays. That would have been a good choice, wouldn't it? Maybe they couldn't get the rights. I think what I think is particularly tragic is that, you know, the scene where Pam and Bernard are in the car and she's kind of mouthing what he says.
Yeah.
He knows it so well. It's really sad, isn't it, that we never get any indication that Pam has been able to have any fun at all from this scenario, understandably. You know, and we pick it up. We don't pick it up the first time she goes through it. We're potentially a long way into this loop having played out, aren't we? Just everything about Pam is sad.
Yeah, there's moments throughout the episode that I've picked out, actually, where you think, you know, this has happened a lot. I mean, I talk about, it may not be as much as Heaven Sent, the Doctor Who one, because the Doctor Who one is 2 billion years that he spends in there. But that's a bit more sci-fi, so we'll leave that to one side. Going into the next loop, because we've talked a lot about Mulder and Scully in the first one and getting that connection together. The second one is very much about the variation and you know, playing the comedy for the variation that we've got, but also the Bernard and Pam story as well, because we have to backfill that in. And, you know, the fact that we get that, and then as you mentioned, this loop is where we start to talk about fate versus free will, which we can talk about in a minute. But having to fill in the backstory of Bernard and Pam and, you know, the comedy moments, which we've already seen just on the variation in itself is quite a nice touch.
Well, it's interesting because, like, both of those characters, in kind of a meta way, they're obviously doomed because we're never going to see them ever again. And I don't think there's any expectation from people watching that you will, you know. So something has to happen to resolve this loop, but we'll never see them again. And as we go on, we find out that, It seems kind of sad, doesn't it? You know, he's like, who cares if I get fired? He's says something about mopping floors, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So like the implication is that it's like almost like being trapped in this cycle that's kind of uninteresting. And the way that it's perfectly cast, I think, both of them, because both of them kind of epitomize that sense. You know, they look kind of gaunt and kind of down at heel in a way. And I think that's good because I can sort of imagine this episode where they decide to do a bit more kind of a stunt casting thing. And I don't think they do here. Of course, Carrie Hamilton, she's the daughter of Carol Burnett, isn't she? The American comedian. I think is less well known in the UK, but it's more interesting, I think, to American viewers. And Darren Burroughs, I think, known for the role in Northern Exposure. And what I discovered today, he's actually the son of Billy Drago, who plays the bad guy in Thief. Which I didn't know.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's kind of a cool link.
Oh, okay. I can see that. Okay.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think they really embody
those grounded.
Well.
They're very grounded, aren't they?
Grounded.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The second one with Pam and them, I mean, things like Everything Will Be Roses, you talk about the Pam aspect where you feel like you know she's been through this quite a lot. And it's like, yeah, Everything Will Be Roses. She's that melancholy that, you know, you do start, you have that empathy. And, you know, we'll touch upon it right at the very end with Mulder and typical, you know, Mulder-esque type of him being empathic towards women is kind of like touches upon that as well, which is really interesting. this obviously the comedy again is played out. You know, you've got the things like him falling backwards and stuff, and the waiting for that. I mean, Colm, did you this second time around? I mean, how did you deal with that? And then obviously move into the fate versus free will conversation, which is really intriguing in itself.
I think for me, this second time through is the first time that we are really 100% sure we're in a repeat. Like,
yeah, that's a good
this
point.
Is the
yeah.
first like confirmation that we have that we're actually repeating, because the first time through, we could just be leading up to what we saw, you know, in the intro. There could be a thousand X-Files explanations for why Pam knows yeah. everything that's happening so well.
She's psychic or something.
Right, mm. right. This yeah. could be anything still, until we get to the second time through when we realize for sure we're repeating ourselves, just very slightly different, but obviously, you know, having the same things happen. And which I think is a good time for Mulder and Scully to start talking about fate and free will. I love Scully in this conversation. I mean, I love Scully all the time, but I really love Scully in this conversation where she's kind of just very matter of fact, like, well, we're going to change your fate today. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, Mulder, but we have this meeting, like, we're going to change your fate. Let's, you know, move on. And I think that that's a really good one. Yeah. Good conversation.
I do too. I'm closer to Scully's view. So I think it's appropriate that we stop to discuss
yep.
whether free will does exist or not, because from what I understand, it's a long-standing debate that's spanned like centuries. But, you know, I did
so
like
we'll
10
have
minutes.
No, we're going to have no trouble covering it here then. We're good.
Well, yeah, I did 10 minutes Googling the other day. I feel like I got a pretty good handle on the basic points by now. So the debate is, according to some philosophers, free will is a figment of our imagination. Nobody has it. Nobody ever will have it. Instead, our choices are determined. They're necessary outcomes of events that have already happened, or they're random. You know, and I think the natural instinct is to kind of bristle at that, isn't it? If you say to people, you don't have free will, people will think, will say, what are you talking about? And I think it does depend how you define it to a certain extent. So to what extent are our decisions directed by forces we don't understand? And I think the reason it's an interesting debate is because if we lose our belief in free will as a society, a lot of people think that could be disastrous, you know. Because basically the world is kind of dependent on it in a lot of ways, you know, especially if you think about a country like America, you know, the idea of the American dream, where you can do anything you want if you put your mind to it, you know. Anywhere there's a criminal justice system, which is about the fact that you're responsible for what your actions are. If you say that we don't actually have free will, it kind of undermines all that. So some of the context, sorry to go on. Try and flesh this out. There was a study in the 80s, a guy, Benjamin Libet, and I think this is contentious, but what he showed was that, you know, before somebody moves their hand, there's electrical activity in the brain that signifies that before it actually happens. So the idea of what we experience as our decision to do something is actually kind of an after-the-fact thing. The decision has been made for us before we think we've made it, basically. And I think what other studies have shown is that when people are told that they're not responsible, that basically they're not free agents, they stop seeing themselves as blameworthy for things, and then they start to commit more kind of questionable activities, you know, less willing to learn from their mistakes, less grateful, ruder, that kind of thing. They kind of embrace the dark side. So what some of the people who say there is no such thing as free will say is that free will is an illusion, but we need to defend the illusion, because if too many people start to think we don't have free will,
then we'll have things, chaos theory.
Chaos will reign, basically. Other people have said it more positively than that. You know, they think society should acknowledge that even the worst people, you know, your murderers or whoever, in a way, they're unlucky. They didn't pick their genes. They didn't choose who their parents were. They didn't decide what brain they were going to have. And yet it's the brain that is the source of all their subsequent actions. So in a way, if we recognize that these people were not at fault, we could have a more dispassionate society. You know, we could protect people better. We could be less judgmental. And we just, you know, we'd basically be free from hatred, you know, because we pay a high price for the idea that we're all free to act in the way that we want to do. So I don't know. I'm not fatalistic. I don't believe it's preordained. I don't believe that we were destined to have this conversation today. Everything was leading up to the fact we were going to do this podcast today. I'm sort of more of the belief that the decisions that we make are part of this big chain of cause and effect. You know, but given different, being exposed to different ideas will affect the way we then move through the world, I think.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one. So does free will exist? Yes or no?
So you get all the airtime. Me and Carla just get, yeah, no.
Yes or no.
Okay. Bringing on that, just, what was really interesting this week is a thing called synchronicity, right? Now, we've had some of this discussion off air, you know, about free will, and you know, we've had various different little calls and stuff that we've been talking about it. And for the last week, all I've had is episodes of TV or various different aspects that end up talking about free will. I did a podcast on Red Dwarf last night, and there's a big spiel by the main character that talks about free will. You know, and it's like, where did that come from? I watched a Fringe episode, and because somebody brought up the during that Red Dwarf podcast, they brought up the question of it's synchronicity you're thinking about, because you start to think about something and you see it in other things. And then on the Fringe episode last night, they started talking about synchronicity. And I was like, whoa, this is completely out there. This is no lie. It was like the main character was talking about synchronicity and how things come together and things. I just found it really amazing. So in my answer would be, I don't personally believe that. I think it's, you know, like much like the universe started in a very, very strict, very second law of thermodynamics, where everything is ordered, and what the universe then becomes is just chaos. It effectively just bleeds out, and you know, that's how the universe was created. So I'm very much of that ilk. So Cortland, what say you?
Wow. Well, I tend to think about it more, I suppose, as nature versus nurture than fate and free will. You're correct, right? Murderers don't get to choose their genes or their, you know, parents. None of us get to choose where we're born or who we're born to or anything. You know, all of those things just are determined for us. And then we have to deal with how our nature interacts with our nurture. And I think that that's where our free will is most at play, because kind of, you know, we sort of had this conversation a little bit in our conversations before today, but just because I grew up in a place with all of the same people who do all of the same things, you know, my whole family, with maybe two exceptions, live in the same town that they've always lived in for, I don't know, 50 or 60 years. And I left, I don't live there. You know, and like, that's my free will, maybe, or is, you know, a product of my nature and nurture combined. So I guess I tend to think about it that way. Like, certainly there's a series of decisions and a series of things that happen that lead up to those choices that we make, but then we still make choices, even if the factors that go into those choices are preordained for us.
Yeah. I think Luke Winch looked at it from a science point of view in one of the round tables as well, a while back, where he was saying from a mathematical equation point of view that, and this does come into the episode about this variation thing, that the amount of times in Monday that you can have the same event, but it's slightly changed. If you change the small numbers, the big number doesn't change. I think that's what he was saying. So effectively, that is the preordained element, that you can have as much like different small things change and it won't affect the big number. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it as well, from a mathematical equation point of view.
My instinct is that free will plays less of a part than most of us think it does. And that if we were able to kind of sympathetically embrace that, we could have a more caring society. But I don't think that will ever happen, to be honest. I was looking for jokes about free will. I couldn't find very many good ones, but I got one. So, Kurt, knock, knock.
Who's there?
Free will.
Free will who?
I predicted that you would say that. That's a joke. It's not very good at it. But just that idea that it was a predetermined outcome, basically.
Okay.
What I think is good about the episode is that, like I said, I think it's smart to withhold that until the second go-round, basically. Allow these themes to gradually accumulate and then get into the meaty stuff. And I like the way it's always kind of balanced. Like, you've got this discussion going on. You've also got Scully's reaction to the waterbed, which is a nice comic thing.
Amazing.
Well. So it never gets too heavy. It's always kind of nicely balanced. And I like the way it plays out this time. This is the loop, isn't it, where, like, Scully goes to the bank, you know. So not only is Kim Manners shooting scenes like the apartment scene differently, which is fun, like the camera's on the other side of the shoes, but you get these various different twists on it. Like, Scully goes to the bank, but it still ultimately plays out.
Yeah, I think I've got that down as the third loop, because the loop I'm looking at it is where it's all rest is all predestined, and it's when the police come in into the final scene, and the third loop is more.
I thought the third one was where Mulder goes to the cash point,
to the ATM.
It's where Pam has done. This is the notes I've made anyway. Pam goes on tour. That's when she goes on the bank. That's the third time. It's the first post credit. It's actually, in theory, it's the fifth one. And we're going to get really confused right now, because you've got the credits. No. You've got the title credits. You've got the first loop. The second loop is the variation where we start to talk about the predestined stuff, and the police come in. And I like the aspect of where the police come in, because that leads on to the finale act. Then the third loop is when Pam goes on the tour.
Right.
Yeah, that's good. That's good when she comes in, because up until that point, she'd been kept separate. And so she either appears, you know, she appears outside the bank, and we get used to that. And then when she appears in the FBI building, it gives you a bit of a jolt, doesn't it? Because the FBI building had been quite light-hearted by comparison. It's where they discuss these things. It's where they have the dull meeting. So I liked that kind of switcheroo,
yeah,
as it were.
I do, just before we move past the second loop. It has one of my favorite, well, probably one of my favorite little moments from this episode, because in the second loop, if I'm correct about calling it the second loop, that's when Bernard he threatens to shoot Scully, and he says, "I'll shoot her." And Mulder says, "What do you think I'll do then?" That's one of my favorite little lines in this episode, because it goes right back to, I mean, Bernard should know what Mulder is going to do if he shoots Scully, but also Mulder knows what he's going to do if Bernard shoots Scully. And, like, does he have a choice in, like, making that decision? And it's one of those things where it's like, we all know exactly what will happen, yeah, because we know what Mulder is sort of predetermined choices are in that moment.
Yeah.
There's
one moment in the second loop I wanted to ask you about, Cortland, because I've never understood if it's a particular reference to something. It's the moment, it's in the FBI office when Mulder realizes that actually he has to go to the bank, I think.
Yeah.
And he says, "Endorsed my damn check stub." And he says it in kind of a weird fashion. I'm wondering, is that, what's that all about?
I don't know. I always think he's singing it, right? Yeah. And he's meant to be singing it to the tune of Zippity Doo Dah. I don't think he nails it, if that's what they were going for. But I think it's, for me, I always wonder about that too, why he says it in such a strange tone. But in my mind, it's a callback to the singing. It's the singing, just Mulder zippity-doo-dying his way through this terrible day.
Do you know, Kurt? I was wondering if it was from a jingle or something.
No, I don't know. No. It's always thrown me a bit of a loop.
Hey. I like the fact, and it's a very minor thing, but I like the fact that the newspaper hits the door slightly differently each time. You know, it reinforces that sense of not only stuck in the cycle, but no two iterations of the same action are exactly the same. You know, the way the actors read very similar lines slightly differently. Yeah. It's that kind of thing, which is fun about the episode, I think. The camera's in different places from scene to scene and so on.
The other thing I really like too, as we move through the loops, every time we see Mulder kind of having this terrible wake up, I think he's a little more irritated by it. You know, he seems it's a little less funny and a little more pissed each time we go through it. And I think that's really good.
The deja vu loop, because that's what I'm going to call it. There's a deja vu loop, and then we know what we're talking about. It feels that one felt to me and it felt to me like that's when he knows something's not right. He plays that as like, some, you know, I know already, you know, it's kind of like subconsciously he's already aware that he's in that loop at that point.
Well, he plays it very well, doesn't he? Because like deja vu is not a feeling you can really convey on screen directly, but the way he kind of is like, you know, that look on his face.
Yeah, he pauses, at the desk especially. Yeah. That's a really good one.
That's very effective, I think. So he plays it very well. That whole discussion is interesting too.
And I think too, like seeing it start to weigh on Mulder that way, it's easy to then look at Pam and think, oh no, like this, you know, this is Mulder after the maybe three times that we see it. And we know that Pam has experienced it 50 times or 100 times or however, and like imagine what it would feel like after that many times through.
Well, especially when she makes the comparison of it being like a needle stuck in a groove. And that whole scene where she speaks with Mulder, really, her anguish is very palpable, isn't it?
Yeah. And the thing saying that, you know, she's in a hell jumped out at me because, you know, the fact that you are replaying the same moment time and time again. And it's something that actually the TV show Lucifer picks up on, because the version of hell that they have is that you replay the same, like your worst, like moment on earth, you replay that time and time and time again, and that's your version of hell. So it's a nice little you know, visual representation of hell, that you know, that she's having to live this moment time and time again. And as you say, stuck in a groove is a perfect example of that, and I think it works really well. When we do talk about the he's got a bomb aspect, I mean, I think that there's not a lot that you can really do to get yourself out of this loop apart from doing that. I don't think there's another way you could have done that.
This is what I was going to ask you about, Kurt, because I feel like in some of the more sci-fi time loop stories, they maybe justify the loop a bit more with, you know, some kind of event has happened or something, whereas this is more thematic, isn't it? There's no real... I've seen some minor criticism of the episode for that, like, how is this happening? There's no plausible scientific explanation for it. Is that the case? Is that what you've seen in these other time loop stories, that there's more of a justification for the whole concept?
Well, the cause and effect in Star Trek is an interesting one on how they get out of it. But the things like White Tulip on Fringe is more like a science fiction trope anyway. And it's just, it's all played that eventually he'll get an envelope at the end of the episode and he thinks it's from God or it's a sign, even though he has no, it's like Dreamland with the coin in the bed. He doesn't know where it's come from and it's moved on. So the play, it's slightly different. In Doctor Who, he becomes aware of the loop because it's science fiction. Whereas in Star Trek, Cause and Effect, this is the closest that you get in Monday to that, because in that, they use a scientific way by using the android data to recognize the number three. And throughout the episode, on one loop, he's seeing threes everywhere. And he gets at the very end of that episode, there's two people that are giving him options. He's got two options, and he sees on Riker's collar three pips, and he by seeing that, he knows that's the loop he needs to, or the option he needs to go to, and the break out the loop. So it is a difficult one for X-Files to do, because it's not based in that kind of science fiction trope. So I think, you know, as you say, thematically, all that going through that deja vu, I think using the glitch, it's like, you know, the neurochemistry that Mulder talks about, and having this glitch that, you know, a second chance to replay this life. I know it's like many chances. I think works just about for me. Does it work for you, Colin?
No. No. This is where I think I lose it a little bit, is in the way out of the loop. I appreciate the deja vu. I think the deja vu loop is really good. I think that he does a really good job showing that he's having deja vu, that he's starting to recognize that maybe this is familiar to him in some way. I think that ultimately the he's got a bomb part is a little less effective for me. I think we already know Mulder is prone to making these like intuitive leaps. He does this regularly. That's how he solves X-Files all the time. Like, he makes these like crazy leaps that no one can imagine. I'm not sure that we really needed the he's got a bomb part of it.
So okay then. So if that's the case, I mean, I took it that he was, because he was open to it, that you might be able to play around with that a little bit because he's naturally available. If it was Scully, it wouldn't really work. You would have to have, I would have thought, Pam to have more agency and the Hatchie have her do something to be able to get out of it, I would have thought, Carl. If that was...
Well, she does in the end, doesn't she? Because she throws herself in front of the bullet. So
yeah.
I think, in a way, the episode's reassuring in some senses because you've got these themes of like being helpless and not having free will, but they're kind of in this narrative that ultimately reinforces the sense that our heroes can shape the future because Mulder figures things out. Pam is able to exert some level of control over her fate, albeit it's very tragic. I don't know. Is it undercut? I was wondering this. So on the one hand, you've got that, you know, that they control events or that they manage to shape their will over events. But Bernard is never really reached in the same way, is he? They never find a way to make him not a murderer or a bank robber. although he does have one moment I didn't quite like as much is, I don't want to skip ahead too much, but you know, right at the very end when he shoots Pam, I would have liked a bit more of a reaction from him. He just kind of slumps to the floor, you know.
I think that's his final kind of like, that's the end of his actual world, isn't it? You know, the fact that he's, yeah. You know, he's down on his luck anyway. This is his final kind of throw of the die, and the fact that, you know, he then kills the very person that's keeping him alive. And then that, I mean, I think the whole episode revolves around that, isn't it? It's Pam's the whole point of the episode, and that includes Bernard because that's his world.
Well, and Mulder as well. It's a Mulder piece because you get the kind of, you identify with him going through this bad day and, you know, the bed's leaking and he needs to cash a check and all of that. And you get that kind of cathartic feeling of watching him figure things out, albeit through these intuitive loops, which maybe don't make that much sense. But I think it works for me. One thing I liked in Act 4 is the way it starts with the slow-mo shots of Mulder, you know, his feet hitting the floor, him looking at the watch on the phone. Because we didn't have much slow-mo before that. There's some slow-mo explosions right at the outset in the teaser, which gives it this kind of high-impact thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've got this down as well. I mean, I think the slow-mo really kind of emphasizes the tiredness in the episode, the fact that they've gone through this so many times. It's like, oh, right, okay. And it does a really good visual way of showcasing that, you know, and this whole act is all about Pam giving up. You know, it literally is. She's, you know, the fact that Mulder's actually getting to the point now, it's almost like a crossover of, I'm realizing what's happening here. Do I recognize you? And the one thing I don't like about it, and I don't know why, it's the way Mulder says, I'm sorry to bother you. I don't know why. It just...
Oh, when she...
At the car. Yeah. I'm sorry to bother you. I don't know why. I don't know why. It just doesn't seem to fit properly. But
well, he's interrupting her morning of sitting in the car.
But the fact that she's given up Cortland is you know, and you know, she's been trying so much out of the whole episode to, like, you know, she knows what people are going to say because she's been through it so many times. It's indicating that this has been through hundreds of times it's happened. But now she's just resigned to the fact that it's not going. And it's the same with the FBI building. It feels like she would have had to go through that loop on several occasions to make sure she knew exactly where Scully was going to be from the tour. So the amount of times she would have been stopped, you know, and so she has to learn those movements just to get there. So the fact she's given up on this fourth time is an interesting development.
I do want to talk about that Scully scene really quickly. It's really interesting to me that we have, I mean, this is season 6 Scully, so, you know, pretty far into her journey, but she doesn't ask Mulder not to go to the bank, but she sort of suggests maybe don't go to the bank, which I think is a pretty bold move for Scully the skeptic to believe that there's any credence to what this person in the hallway has just told her. I appreciated that moment from Scully of like, well, wait a second, something is maybe weird happening, you know. I thought it was a good Scully moment.
Yeah. Well, if somebody said to you, like, you know, I had a dream there was going to be a plane crash and you were due to, like, fly that day.
No, of course. Yeah.
You would feel a bit iffy about it, wouldn't you? So
I would. I'm always a little surprised that Scully believes her, though, because she's pretty dismissive, you know, just like, ugh, okay, go back to your tour. But you know, as soon as it becomes possibly relevant, she, you know, is pretty quick on it. I just appreciate that.
We don't get the, like, a thematic convo between Mulder and Scully in this final act, do we? I don't think. We get the slow-mo and we focus more on Pam and Bernard, it seems like to me.
Yeah. Just going back to the plane crash thing. I have been banned from driving in America because of a dream. I think Sarah had.
I thought it was, I had a dream.
Oh, was you?
You were driving.
It was you, yes.
You were driving me home from the pub. Kathy Glinski was there as well. And you kept falling asleep at the wheel. So
yeah, so I'm not allowed to drive in America, which is great.
It felt so real. yeah, I think it's a tragic ending, isn't it? It's satisfying, though, I think. Like, she's cycled through all the variables. She's tried Skinner, she's tried Scully, she's tried Mulder, which looked promising because Mulder was able to put Bernard down, but he sets off the bomb on the ground in Act 3. And finally, it's up to her to make the move. And presumably, she's tried various other people to try and influence this event too. So the fact that it comes down to her is very sad. But it works for me on the dramatic.
Yeah, and it works as well because she never thought to go in the bank herself. She never actually, in all the time that she's done that, she's never thought that she might be the variable. And I just think that there's a bit of like, there's a bit of kind of psychology involved in that. The fact that, you know, she's the one thing that can make things happen, and she can't factor it in her head to do that. And I think that's really interesting as well.
Yeah.
I think for me, that's a little bit where I feel like we're missing some pieces. I think ultimately, right, what has won is the idea of repetition. This is repeated enough times that Mulder manages to remember or remind himself that there's a bomb. And so I think I would have liked to see a little bit more, even if it was just one scene maybe, of Mulder and Pam figuring out that if she goes into the bank, something different could happen. And then we move into she goes into the bank and confront, you know, even if it, I'm not sure exactly what the structure there could have been, but I think that if what we're going to rely on is repetition, then maybe we needed a little bit more. And I think it would have been interesting to see Pam convince Mulder one more time, like as he's remembering, like as he's experiencing deja vu.
I mean, Mulder takes, as I say, Mulder takes the onus of it, doesn't he, because he phones Scully and tells her to get Pam, bring her in.
I think it's missing a little bit there for me. I think I would have liked a little bit more.
And of course, because Mulder goes over and talks to Bernard, the woman gets hysterical, which is, as I say, he's in the bank, but he's not near her. So I like how it kind of wraps up as well, because, you know, we've had these variables, we've had the police being named by them, we've had the police sirens before, and then obviously the police sirens are here again, and the looks on both Mulder and Scully faces are like, okay, yeah, right, okay. And I think that particular element really works for me.
It's good how all the stuff at the bank is suitably tense throughout, isn't it? You know, even though there are other scenes in the episode which are lighter in tone, I'm always kind of quite gripped by the drama at the bank.
Yeah,
you know, in every iteration of it. So yeah, I like
that. What about Mulder and the fact that he actually gives him the gun and says, "You're in control now"?
I was wondering it, because he says, "You can change your fate." So the implication to me is quite bleak, because Bernard never takes that opportunity to change his fate. You know. Which it could have been another way to do the episode, couldn't it? You can imagine this story more oriented around him, and he decides to walk away. And he never does. In fact, all that happens is the loss of life is less widespread. So it's a shame. I wonder if there's anything that could have been done to reach him. It appears not. And that is because free will does not exist.
Well, preordained.
What do you think, Colin?
Well, I guess that's a little bit what I'm saying. Like, I think he doesn't take that opportunity, right? But we only see Pam take this opportunity once, and it's only because Mulder does it. I don't know. Yeah.
And it's quite instinctive, isn't it? It's like, you know, she throws herself in front of the gun.
Yeah, yeah. So
almost unthinkingly.
Like, Pam is so convinced that it's Mulder that she never, you know, I think that if we're going to talk about fate and free will, like, Pam was, I guess, fated to die in the bank, and that's why it was stuck on the loop, but she had never made the choice to go in the bank before. And Mulder now made this choice for her. And it's really interesting.
I think I know what you're saying. So like a scene where Mulder says, it's down to you, Pam. You need to reach Bernard, right, or something like that.
I think that it should have been more of Pam's choice, I guess, or decision. I don't know.
Yeah, as I said before, taking more agency and more like hold of it. Right.
Because I mean, she makes that split second choice, but we don't see her decide to go in. We don't even see Scully really, you know, we see her like knock on the window or whatever, but I think that we're missing a little bit there for me.
We've been predestined to end on that note.
Yeah, and I don't know what you guys think, but maybe we should actually end on that note, because we've gone over an hour here, haven't we? So, I mean, it's good that people left us some mailbag stuff, but...
Wait, sorry, Carl. Next week. Can you guys hear that noise? There's like a little ticking or something? Do you hear it?
What? No, hang on. What is... Hang on, I don't like the sound of that.
Oh, no.
I mean, what do you think to Mulder's empathy then? Because right at the very end, we get that final scene, don't we, where it's Tuesday, for example. And you've got Mulder on the couch. We've got Mulder on the couch. So that's clearly defined that the fact that he's given up on the waterbed. But, and we do get that kind of, you know, the mold of kind of women, the empathy kind of mold in this column, don't we?
Yeah. I really like, first of all, I really like the misdirect of the newspaper. One more time, which on my notes is number 7, but that's okay. I really appreciate the misdirect of the newspaper and then Mulder asleep, but it turns out he's on the couch and wearing different pajamas. Everyone will be reassured to know. I think it's another example. Yeah, I think you're right. It's another example of Mulder's particular empathy. And especially considering he can't remember all of the times that this has happened. He just has a sense of the weight of it. And I think that that's done well at the end here, of like how heavy this memory will be, even though he doesn't have even all of the memories that go with it.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think to the end of then, Carl?
Yeah, I like it. I think that, like Colin says, the sort of, the newspaper is fun. The idea that, okay, is this the loop? No, it's not. The fact that events have definitively been put in the past by the fact that there's this newspaper story as well, I like. Interesting to have a Mulder and Scully closing convo done over the phone, which doesn't happen all that often. I suppose it happens sometimes, but, you know, the kind of convo they often have in the office or wherever. One thing I was going to mention earlier is that, so she's surprised by the waterbed, isn't she? So he's had that waterbed for quite some time. So she hasn't been in his apartment in quite a while, has she? So that's relevant to various debates.
you've opened a can of worms there. Jesus.
Oh, no. I actually really love, though, that this episode reintroduces the waterbed. That's another thing I think this one does really well. It just drops in a few things like the waterbed, things like the bank that we'll see this bank again. I mean, not this particular bank, but this bank.
Craddock Marine.
Yeah. Yes.
Amazing Mellini, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like, I think little things like that, or even the agent, the actor that played, that it's sort of a little bit world building in that way. But I like that the waterbed comes back. I like that we get to see Scully and Mulder puzzle over how that waterbed got there.
it's a nice little touch, isn't it? Because as I say, with Monday being quite a mundane episode, you would never, ever have time to have this discussion. I think it's a perfect episode to do it in.
Exactly.
We haven't mentioned Skinner's contribution that much either, but it's fun to see him in that meeting too, isn't it? Kind of like, you know, fretting over Mulder's appearance or non-appearance as well.
You can just imagine he hasn't obviously worked as a superior to them for some time. This is obviously a cross benefit kind of, you know, let's bring people from different departments in. And he's like, oh, well, they haven't changed, have they?
But too, we get to see, you know, in the teaser, we get to see Skinner like running up really worried that his agents are inside that bank that they're in danger. And it's a very cute little Skinner moment in the teaser as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he does get a few bits, doesn't he? You know, let's say with Pam running to him and, you know, and trying to involve him in that. And, you know, the concern that he has, as I say, in different loops, it's clear that he does have an affinity and a care for them.
Yeah, that line about the unpredictable future, which leads me to Agent Mulder.
It's a good one. That's so good. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Should we go into the mailbag then? Should we see what other people have been saying about this episode?
Let's do it.
Sure.
Okay. Okay, so Christian Ponce says, I consider it the exact moment when the series stopped being a science fiction series to become a fantasy series. In the first season, there are very marked effort to justify monsters as genetic mutants, but especially in the Los Angeles era, any scientific justification is abandoned to enter definitively into the Twilight Zone. Still, I really love this episode.
Don't you think that happened a bit earlier with stuff like Synchrony? Kind of opened the doorway a little bit for these episodes. These later episodes are more along that line, I suppose. I don't see Monday as like the starting point of that. I feel like there have been other episodes that are less grounded in the way the early seasons were already.
So, because season six in itself has quite a few, hasn't it? So, I mean,
But we've already had like Triangle, for example.
Right. I mean, I think it goes back to what you're saying. There's no reason given for why this is happening to Pam. Like, other than the fact she was, I guess, supposed to die and didn't.
Yeah, and Mulder does have that end comment, you know, which is like a Twilight Zone ending, isn't it, really? You know, to like basically say, I think she was just trying to get away, which is very much like, you can imagine a voiceover kind of saying that Outer Limits, Twilight Zone-esque. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's too over. I think you're right with Synchrony. I think that's probably a really good one to point, because that's the science fiction trope that, you know, X-Files is in science fiction world there. But this is still, for me, it still has theme. It's not, you know, you mentioned about the Star Trek episode earlier, Carl, about the how did episodes get out of this. And X-Files has a struggle to do that because it's trying to play out the theme of free will. So I think, yes, there's an argument for it, but having the theme be part of it and be a major talking point is probably what sort of delineates it a little bit.
But Christian said he really liked the episode. Is that right?
Yeah. Luke says, Luke Winch, my favorite episode of season six, with its themes of fate and self-determinism, mixed with how the idea of how minor variables do not affect the whole. This episode plays with big ideas in an effective, often comical way that makes this episode stand above others in season six. Technically brilliant in its execution, with tragedy and pathos laced through the story of Pam. This episode plays with macro existential questions in a brilliant and intellectual way.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the examples I mentioned to you guys off air was Sliding Doors with Gwyneth Paltrow, where, you know, I can't remember exactly what it is, but she makes one decision and it kind of affects the whole shape of her life or whatever. And she gets different hairstyles, which is handy so you can kind of keep track of it as a viewer. So it's kind of different to what he's talking about, isn't it? Because in Monday, the idea is that, you know, maybe you trip over the shoes on the floor going forwards. Maybe you do it going backwards. You know, that might play out slightly differently, but the big notes continue to be hit. Whereas the Sliding Doors type thing is slightly different, isn't it? Where a single decision can change things dramatically. I can't remember how that film resolves, though.
Oh, it's been a long, long time since I've seen it. The thing about Doctor Who, talk about Doctor Who to a point, is that Doctor Who have the thing about a fixed point in time, so things can change. Things can be, you know, you can have free will, but there's a fixed point. And I think if you're relating it to Monday, the fixed point is Pam being killed. So that is the big variable, the one that's immovable. Everything else around it can move around until...
to a degree, yeah.
So that's where the glitch in the record is. It's the very nature of that moment. Everything else around it is free will. You know, if you wanted to go down that route, it's just that's a really important part of time, and it gets stuck in that mold.
Do you guys ever think about this in terms of your X-Files fandom? Like, do you ever think about things like, well, what if Gillian Anderson had been late to her audition, you know, or what if the second film had been released in the winter and had made more money, it had a better advertising campaign? Did we get the third movie? Does that mean we don't get a revival? What if I hadn't started watching at the time I started watching? Would I have ever become a fan? Would I be a different type of fan? What if I never went on Twitter and started tweeting about the X-Files? Like,
yeah,
would I be here today? Like, Colin, do you ever think about these kind of things?
Well, I think I certainly reflect on my own choices about it. I don't know that I would necessarily reflect on other people's choices, if that makes sense. I don't, you know, if Gillian Anderson was late to her audition, I don't know. Would we even have the show? I have no idea. But I mean, I'm glad she wasn't late. So I think, yeah. I mean, I don't know. How did we get here? How did Kurt wind up doing 9 podcasts this week, you know? But
it was preordained.
Right. It's preordained. No, he chose that. No, I'm just kidding.
I think I chose that.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to think about, but I think if you think about it too hard, then it becomes really difficult to make any choices at all. And you have to make some choices, whether you want to or not.
I think I would say that, say for example, the X-Cast is probably a perfect example of, like, I wouldn't have gone to see David Duchovny and get a picture with him had it not been for the X-Cast.
Maybe you would.
I wouldn't have gone to Chicago had it not been for the X-Cast.
Maybe something else would have happened.
I wouldn't have.
I mean, how do you know?
I just don't see it happening. You know, so it's, I think I have moments like that where you think to yourself, you know, it's an interesting place that I'm currently in because of X, Y, and Z. But as of like what could have been, I don't think that way. I think what has been. So do you often think, do you have to like lie down and look at the stars and think, oh, if I hadn't have gone for that curry last night,
like, is
that
for instance, job interview where you think, if I'd have answered that question more confidently, or if I'd have said something slightly different, would that have been enough? Would I have got the job? And if I did get that job, would I be here where I am now? You know, that kind of thing. Those kind of turning point moments where you could see it folding and unfolding in a completely different way. I do think about those things, yes.
See, I wouldn't. My thing is definitely more on a case of what I've done to be where I'm at now rather than thinking about what could have been. What about you, Colin? How do you view the world?
Yeah, I think I'm more like you. I think I definitely will ponder back on decisions that I made that I feel like led me to where I am. I try not to think about it in the way that Carl has just described. I think that would give me even more anxiety than I already have now.
It's too prolific that you're thinking like that. But like, don't you never have
times
where you get a fully formed memory returned to you of something you did, which was just like mortifying or embarrassing. And you think, oh my God, I'm such a doofus. Oh, just me. No.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
I have those. I try not to think about how I might have made a different decision changed my whole life.
Yeah, it's definitely why did I do that? Never mind.
Right. Let's try not to remember that anymore.
Oh, psychology. We could be here all. We need someone with a psychology degree. So, Paige Schechter is also on. She says, brilliant episode and possibly the best showcase of Kim Manners' gifts. At the very least, it's the first one I think of. What a challenge to have to keep refilming the same day, yet I can never just look away. I'm looking for the signs of how the day will be different while barreling towards the conclusion. My top marks are reserved for Carrie Hamilton in the extraordinary performance. We do feel the heft of repeated days weighing on her incrementally. It's so sad she left us so early, and we can only imagine what she would have given to the world otherwise. We got some of the standout guest performances.
I was going to mention that, but it's very sad when you know that she died just a few years after this, isn't it? And I think she was in her 30s still, I believe. Mm. Very sad. It's interesting what she says about Kim Manners' page there, because I always think of him and the more grisly horror episodes, but it's definitely a good showcase for him.
I think he does I think Kim Manners has always done the kind of the emotional aspects quite well. And so, and I think that by the mundanity of it and having to change the scenes ever so slightly, I think he was built to direct it. Yeah, it's a nice thing, but to be able to block and to do these scenes time and time again, it would really be interesting to see how they worked around it, because obviously they're going to be filming different ones. Did they just arbitrarily put in, right, Mulder's going to do this, this, and this? Or are they just saying, David Duchovny, do what you want with this, play different variations? Would it be nice to see how they actually filmed it that way?
I think it must have been quite planned.
Mm.
That's my instinct. And I think that would have been a nice challenge to do.
Well, and I think, too, the way they fit them all together, you know, because we see the same thing over and over, but I yeah. think that they fit in enough new pieces kind of interspersed that it doesn't feel like just constant repetition.
Yeah.
I think that was excellent.
Yeah. And as I say, adding moments like the slow motion bit, you know, for yeah. a visual gag is really good. Michael Little just says, great script and one of the best of season six. And Andromeda Gomez says, wonderful episode. Ronald Wilson, okay, why didn't you post this yesterday? Hey. Or were you stuck on the loop too long? Well, Ronald, we don't know which loop we're in, so it's fine. We're all in different loops. Tony, too easily cast off as the X-Files was Groundhog Day, as Carl mentioned earlier. For my money, when the time loop episode has a much broader precedence, this is one of the best gimmick episodes the series ever did. It has all the tropes, all the loop tropes, but combines them with the modernity behind the life of Mulder and Scully. We would never ordinarily see in a wonderfully dry way. And the pathos and the domestic bomber's trapped girlfriend and tragic mechanism are out of the loop, and you would have a simple, extremely well-told story that doesn't feel superfluous. A season six and indeed series of overall highlight. Would you say, Colin, would this be a highlight for the show entirely?
I've never done a full ranking of all of the episodes. I know there are people out there who have. But I think, yeah, I think it would certainly be in the top half for me if I was to do that or to try to rank them. So I think highlight. I think that's a safe bet.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking... Yeah. Just in the last few weeks, I watched Milagro because Sarah was talking about how she was going to record that episode. And I thought, I really like Milagro. Let's watch that again. And that is rising up the pile for me. Monday, like I said, I appreciate even more than I did before. And we've got Field Trip coming up, which is one of my very favorites, I think, of the series. So there's some really good stuff in the season, isn't there? A lot of people say that they like the first half of season six more than the second, but I feel like my favorite episodes are in the second half, although the worst episodes are also in the second half with, you know, Alpha and Trevor and but the good stuff is so good.
Eleanor Butler, Scully's line, "I just want everyone to live," is one of my favorites. It sums up who she is, life-affirming, empathetic. I always get that word mixed up, empathetic, and driven by values. It echoes, how can you have too much life in Tithonus? Oh, she's actually said the same thing I did. And I think both are said with the memories of Melissa, Emily, and Samantha circling her mind. Life is good. Life is to be explored. Life is to be challenged and pushed and stretched, which is why she finds her work on The X-Files so intellectually rewarding. It focuses on life. Carl, do you focus so much on life that you feel life is
there
good?
There have been times in the last year or so where that has been a challenge to maintain that outlook. My feeling is that, well, I don't want to get too nihilistic, but the universe is quite a bleak thing, in my opinion. So if you're able to focus on wonderful distractions like the X-Files, that's a very satisfactory state of affairs. So, yeah, life is good, really good. Glad to be here. Glad to be with both of you. It's fun.
Matt Latham, magnificent masterpiece. I could easily watch a highlight of what's probably been favorite season of the show. Alison Cassidy, we've got to get this line in. Three words, yellow pajama pants.
There it is.
Do you know what? I wanted to reply with one word, Bob, but I thought, well, maybe she doesn't know who that is. But I won't do that.
She knows. Okay. I can't imagine she would be commenting about yellow pajama pants if she didn't know.
Oh man, Andrew Levitt says that I didn't like Monday on my first viewing because it seemed like more of the same dumb comedy as the first half of season six. It came across as very depressing in the mundaneness of Mulder and Scully's lives, and the looped day becomes very repetitive. But over time, I've come to enjoy the episode, appreciating Kim Manners' attempt to make each day different despite their similarities. The humour which Mulder's waterbed is fun. Mulder and Scully discuss some deeper issues about life and repetition. The bank robbery scene is really tense each time, and Pam being stuck in a loop with Bernard, trying to make something of himself, another Vince Gilligan episode with a little man wanting to be bigger than he is a nice allegory about being stuck in an abusive relationship. The only thing that jars me is Mulder's remembering what's going on to happen in the next loop, but it's conveyed in a most convincing way, so I usually let that pass. An 8 out of 10 from me. So that's an interesting one, actually, because you know I'm used to sci-fi doing this element. It's not something that everyone will be accustomed to. It's an interesting trope, and it can become repetitive. And we've mentioned about Kim Manners doing the directional part of it, but to be able to, like, it is a skill to be able to keep people interested with this, because, you know, some people might be turned off by that.
Do you think so? Because, like, Groundhog Day had such broad appeal, didn't it? Like, I've never really heard people dislike that film because of the concept. Maybe there are people, I don't know. Actually, Colin, weren't you saying that there was somebody who hates this episode?
Yes. She's not in the X-Files. She's not in the basement. But I was just talking to her right before we started recording today. And her name is also Sarah, so confusing. And she said, you know, what are you recording? And I explained, we're recording about Monday. And she, her immediate and gut reaction was, I hate that one. She hates it. She doesn't like to rewatch it. She does not find it funny at all. And thinks it's quite sad that we just watch Mulder and Scully die over and over again, which is fair. I think that's fair. I was surprised. I mean, I think she's the only person I've talked to who doesn't like it, but she's not bothered by that.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's generally got good praise, which is, you know, as I say, there's not many people that have a dislike for it. And it is interesting how some people do not necessarily like it to begin with, but have grown to like it as well. I think that's quite an interesting kind of repetition in a few things that's happened here that our people have made comments to say that they weren't too fond of it and then eventually they've grown to like it. Chris Knowles has said, I'll lapse into some Bostonese and declare this one to be Wicked Messiah. That translates to truly outstanding, commendable and praiseworthy.
I thought we were going to get a Boston accent there, Kurt.
Colin,
can you do it?
No.
Trust me, you do not want to hear me do accents. It is not
too Midwestern not. For I'm.
I could try a Boston accent because I've seen The Departed. So
yeah,
what did he say? A wicked pisser.
You're not going to get me to trying to do that. Last time I tried an accent, it had to be cut. it didn't go well. Becky Desborough. This is my favourite episode of all and brought me back to watching after a long break. I suddenly had a strong desire to watch it in December and then watched it the whole series straight through, having never seen the second film or the revival. So many great episodes, but this remains my favourite.
Yeah, that's good. And I believe Becky's only just joined the basement, so I'm not sure if she's listening to the podcast or not. If you are, Becky, hello, and we're glad to have you. It's funny, isn't it? It's good to hear that people are coming back to the show as well.
Yeah. I mean, just the... And there's been a few people like that over the last couple of years where you've seen them appear and, you know, finding a new love for it. I know someone that's actually watching the show for the first time, you know, and they're thoroughly enjoying it. It's just nice to see, you know, that it is people, we're picking up fans or people watching it at least, even so many years down the road. And it'll be interesting, especially in the UK with Disney Plus now showing the X-Files on there, whether or not the viewership goes up. On that, because you know it's going to be a bit more readily available for those people who have Disney Plus.
Yeah, we should. I feel like we could discuss that on a that could be a bonus episode, like how soul destroying it is that Disney owns the X-Files. But no, just my cynicism.
Is it in nihilism coming back again?
Yeah.
Right. Pamela Stafford also says, I like the action of it, the bombing, the near death scenes, the emotion. I really like the nuances in the different day. Every day is not the same. I find that it's really interesting. I am extremely fond of the yellow pajama pants. And on that note, we should maybe call the episode to an end.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking that my initial instinct was we should just skip the social media handles and stuff.
Yeah.
But I've changed over the course of this discussion. I've gone through a character arc. And I feel like the only way we're going to get out of this loop is if I tell you that I'm on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. I'm also in the X-Files basement on Facebook, so you can find me there. Cortland, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CWB, C-E-E, the word double, the letter U, B-E-E.
Excellent. And you can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake, R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E, along with our other host of X-Files podcasts, X-File podcasts, what am I talking about? Oh, so we have podcasts. As I say, I've been working on nine in the past like 3 days. you can find me on Make It So at Jean-Luc Poddard, which is a Star Trek Picard podcast, a Red Dwarf podcast called Shipwrecked and Comatose at Red Dwarf Pod. And as I say, if you want to just keep an eye on the other ones, just by all means go to Twitter at @rmuldrake. So yes, thank you very much both guys for coming on and talking about Monday. It's been a pleasure as always. But until next time, remember, trust no one.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, network chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/... We Made This, that's patreon.com/ We Made This, and get the ball rolling. Elsewhere on We Made This. The time is now, a Millennium podcast.
I hate Hollywood. I hate the way these stories are told. It's everything, they hit the same beats, they hit the same rhythms. It's kind of like, it reminds me of like a blues thing, you know, where it's like, well, a lot of people love the blues, but you know, it just, I realize that it's everything has the same underlying structure, you know, everything is like 12 bar, 1-4-5, pentatonic, you know, everything is following the same core elements, and it just gets exhausting after a while.
I remember going to see Gary Moore, and you know, as much as I enjoy music, I enjoy going to see bands and things, and after about, I'd say, 30 minutes, I was like, I need to check out.
We Buy Records.
How much would you sell this record for on Discogs? Now, the record in question is Microsoft DOS on a vinyl album, which you can actually boot a PC with.
You've got to be kidding.
I'm not kidding. Does this sound bringing back any memories? From what I can gather, it looks like they've done it as a hobby project. But if it was commercially available...
All it needs is an incredibly vaporwave sleeve. And I guarantee that hipsters would pay a fortune for that.
We are Starfleet.
So this was kind of a nice callback to the elements that were used on TOS. And it really stuck out to me. And it just, as I keep saying every week, you know, there's always a little give and take, right? Where the writers bring in this element from TOS or TNG or from Voyager, and it fits into the Discovery realm.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they didn't draw out Giorgio seeking medical attention for her issue. Is a little worried.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the XCast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.